Ladies and gentlemen, in just a few moments, we start our daily broadcast.
Who listens to radio?
Hi, I'm Dave Denton. I'm a radio guy, and even went by that name on the air in Missouri. This is Radio Guy Reflections. Radio Guy Reflections is brought to you by daysvoiceworks.com. Spell works, W-O-R-X. And listen to some celebrity interviews, demos, podcasts like Radio Guy Reflections, 3W News, and Turnbuckle Trash. Some of our past guests have included 2021 Sportscaster of the Year for the Utah, Scott Girard, a good friend of mine, KT and Carrie Kelly, a husband and wife morning team in New Mexico, where they talk about doing a morning show with having an autistic child. And Jeff Katz, a talk show host in Richmond, Virginia, has also joined us. Richard Buckle, whose career goes from one side of the world to another. He started in the historic pirate radio off the coast of Great Britain and now runs a station in a resort town in Thailand. But today, I'm really looking forward to this one because we're joined by another voice familiar to all those in San Antonio, Texas, the longtime morning host of, I believe it was Kono. Is that right, Tom?
Well, I did a lot of things at Kono. Uh-huh. I did various air shifts, and then eventually they wanted to open an on-air traffic department, which is something I'd done before. So they said, if we do this, would you like to put it together from scratch and head it up and then do the morning and afternoon traffic on Kono and the other stations here with the Cox cluster? And I jumped on it and said yes. And I did that until November of 2012 when a whole bunch of us were shown the door.
Oh, that'll happen. This is Tom Carr on Radio Guy Reflections. And Tom, when we were setting this up, even before we started this recording, you and I have just been talking and giggling about things in radio and in our lives. And you sound like a wonderful human, and I'm really, really glad to be able to talk to you on the phone. And thank you so much for joining us on Radio Guy Reflections.
I appreciate you contacting me.
Oh, it's always fun to talk radio because it was a great career over the years. And I think we're going to start off talking about Tom. Tom, where were you born and where were you raised? And then we'll go from there into some early influences that got you into the radio industry.
I was born in Corona, California, Southern California. My dad was a flight instructor in the Marine Corps at the now closed El Toro base and spent some early time there. Then my dad got out of the service. Eventually went with the Quaker Oats Company, and it was a job where if you wanted a promotion, you moved. So we moved a lot, and we got to live in some interesting cities. As it turns out, some cities that back in the 60s and early 70s had just phenomenal live radio talent, and in one case, some great local TV talent as well. And I knew at 7 years old what I wanted to do.
Oh, really? That early, huh?
I mean, I knew I was going to be on radio and TV. I knew I wanted to play the drums, and I knew I wanted to fly airplanes, and if I had time, maybe become a police officer.
you were really driven there. So I know you played the drums. Did you ever learn to fly?
Yes. In fact, that became part of my job for about 17 years.
Wow. That's incredible. Yes. So what was that first job? Or where, you know, what was it that led into that first gig in radio? What got you there?
Well, I listened to so much great talent growing up in places. We lived in Cincinnati, St. Louis, Cleveland, all just some wonderful radio personalities. And I was finishing high school in St. Louis. And a friend of mine that I went to high school with was already interning at a local radio station.
Oh, really?
A guy named Buddy Van Arsdale. Wonderful, wonderful man who went on to have a great career. And so he started teaching me things, and we started going, hanging around local radio stations. And some of these people would let us come in and show us things at night when the brass wasn't around. And eventually I got into a school that had a small radio station that I got very involved in. And then one of my friends there worked at a station about 30 minutes away in Lawrence, Kansas. And he convinced the people there to let me come in after my classes every day and work for free. Well, you know, you're 17 years old.
You're doing anything, yeah.
And so I would do that. And I learned so much because I got to work big time in the news department.
Wow.
And then working on AM and then some weekends on the FM. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful learning experience. So between a full load of classes, two radio stations, and a weekend band, I somehow managed to keep my grades up. But after three semesters of that, I said, I think I just want to work.
Well, so you know, I'm very familiar with St. Louis. I worked and owned a radio station about halfway between St. Louis and Columbia, and actually did a little bit of work at WYL in St. Louis. Not much. I mean, I was just kind of like a fill-in, but they were trying to talk me into coming in. But, owning a radio station has got a lot of you got to work a lot, in other words. And I wasn't making much money. I probably should have moved to WIL. So what part of St. Louis were you – where'd you go to school at and all that?
Kirkwood.
Oh, Kirkwood, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great community. Still a great community. So
it is. It's not the community from when I was a teenager. It has really grown, and there's some serious bucks out there right now.
Yeah, there is some serious bucks. But you grew up listening to like KMOX and
KMOX.
What
KXLK,
a great station. Yeah.
And then when KSLQ came on the air, I mean, that was the big thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and we ended up getting to know some people there, and Buddy and I would go down there at night sometimes, and the guys would show us the ropes, and they were in Clayton, which, you know, Clayton was just gorgeous.
Right. Beautiful.
And the studios were palatial. And remember, there was a legendary morning man at KXOK named Mort Crowley.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And little did I know that in the 80s, I would end up working with Mort.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
And what a wonderful, wonderful human being, and funny. And it's like, I mean, the first time he came into where I was working, I thought, I was like a little kid.
Uh-huh.
I thought, I'm working with Mort Crowley.
Did you ever hear of an announcer back in those days named Johnny Rabbit?
Oh, yes. Yeah, KXOK. Yeah.
I got to meet him a few times, and he actually worked at WYL with my friend Ray Massey. And, you know, so I got to meet him and all that. But St. Louis, even when I left there, you know, 26 years ago, was still such a great radio market. They had every kind of station you can imagine. And every station in St. Louis just sounded great. KC95 and WIL, KMOX, of course, they're legendary in what they've done. So that's
one of my
market.
My former co-workers is at KMOX now.
Oh, really?
Been there for a number of years,
uh-huh.
and they had a guy doing overnights back when I was a teenager at Camo X, a guy named John McCormick, just as smooth could be, and you can still find some of his air checks on YouTube.
Oh wow!
And I mean, just to listen to the way he would do an intro at the top of the hour would just give you goosebumps.
Wow.
I was like, wow, this is radio. I mean, here I am, not at all their target audience, 16, 17-year-old kid. And if I was up late at night, I would listen to him.
Uh-huh. Well, where you grew up, you were saying Cincinnati. Was that, was it WOWO? Is that the station in Cincinnati? I can't remember.
But that was Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
But no, big rock station when I was a kid was WSAI in Cincinnati. Of course, you got the legendary WLW AM 700.
That's what I was thinking of, WLW.
Yeah.
So I used to listen to them myself. So,
and there was I've always thought it was interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, but you had WKYC in Cincinnati, and Cleveland had WCKY.
Yeah.
Now, I may have reversed those two. My memory is slipping, but I always found that a little interesting.
Uh-huh.
Now, you always notice the big tower you see at the beginning of WKRP.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, that was the tower for WKRC Television, Channel 12, which also had a radio station.
Uh-huh.
And when they built that in the early 60s, it was up on a hill, and you could see it from all over, and they used to call it the Eiffel Tower of Cincinnati.
Woo.
And I remember in Cub Scouts getting a tour of their facilities when they were still brand new, And it was just mind-boggling to see all of this. Now, we also, at WLW, they had a television station, Channel 5, which was huge. And they did three 90-minute live television shows a day.
Wow.
With an audience, with an orchestra. And people, especially for that noontime show, which had actually started back in the radio days, people would wait over a year to get tickets. And to go there and watch them do these live shows as a kid and just watching everything going on. I mean, it was just, you to watch this and go, how can they do this? And just some amazing talent that went through there. And then, of course, you know, the radio stations themselves had such legendary figures. Now, when we ended up moving to Cleveland, for a short time, Don Imus was working in the market.
Oh, yeah.
The morning show. And he did a bit called the, I probably won't get this correct, the 101 School of Showbiz Careers, something like that. I don't remember the exact title. But you would call up an audition like you were going to try to get into showbiz. And so myself and my best friend decided to call one morning, and we got on. Fortunately, he had a little cassette player running with a little suction cup thing on the phone. So he said, what are you going to do today? And he said, we will sing the song Misty. And then we put on these big fake voices. You look at me. Well, we didn't realize until after we were done that he was yelling at us.
Oh, really?
And when we're done, he said, sir? And we said, yes. He said, that was beautiful. Never call here again.
So you're no Johnny Mathis then, huh?
Well, we were doing it just to be, you know,
right,
fun kids. But then we listen back to it, and we hear the whole time we're singing, it's going, sir? Sir? Shut up, sir? Sir?
Well, you know, I think I told you the other day that when I was in the seventh grade, there was a radio station called FM 100 in Memphis, and they were having a Craziest Laugh in Memphis contest, and hey, this kid right here won it. I won three whole albums, you know, but it was so much fun that it kind of jump started me into that. But it is interesting how when we're younger and how some of these voices that we talked about and some of the talent that we heard during the, I call it the golden era of radio, how it just has stuck with us. And people like you and, you know, me, our age group, that we revere some of these people. We idolized a lot of them.
Oh, absolutely. One man I wish I'd gotten to meet, he helped me so much in my young career, was a fellow by the name of Jim Palmer out of WCVS in Springfield, Illinois. Not the pitcher.
I was just about to say that.
and he was so nice to me when I was 17 and 18 and getting going, and he would critique my tapes and he would send them out to other people. And I did work for his company for a while. But he was just, you remember these people and you remember the nice things people did for you. And I always told myself, you know, if there were any young people coming in, I was going to do my best, you know, to try to be a good mentor to them as well.
Right.
Because, you know, it can be intimidating coming in, especially when you're young. And, you know, just have somebody just jump all over you. I remember the first time I was really jumped on. And I deserved it. And I was at that station in Lawrence, Kansas, KLWN, AM and FM. And we called it Clown, but not on the air.
Right.
That would get you fired.
Of course.
But my first thing when I would come in the afternoon was the 4 o'clock news on AM. And I'm running in from classes and the news director would have everything ready for me. And I usually have about 5 or 10 minutes to read the copy, get the actuality set up and do it. But one day I was really running late and he handed it to me and I got in there with about 30 seconds to spare, get into it and it's flowing. It's going pretty well. And I'm feeling pretty good about my 18-year-old self. Then I got to the international news, and for the first time in my life, I see the name Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I go, Alexander, so the Russian author dissident. I got off and they said, Tom, Hank wants to see you, the station manager. Uh-huh. He was a big guy, looked like Hoss Cartwright. And he closed the door and just really reamed me out for being unprepared. And he was right. He was absolutely right. And I thought they were going to show me the door, but, you know, I was free, so.
Well, I have a story that is from somebody that's been on our podcast. His name is Art Rascone. And Art just recently retired as a news anchor in Houston, Texas. But I gave Art his first job in radio, and I was still pretty young. And he was reading the news because I was wanting my announcers to actually learn how to announce. And he mispronounced Cairo, Egypt.
Oh, my.
Called it Cario, Egypt. And I've told this story a couple of times, but it is kind of funny. Because I was on a date, and I ended my date, took the girl out there to the radio station. And I very rarely chewed on anybody, but I was chewing on Art pretty good. And told him that he needed to start watching the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather because he needed to learn how to pronounce these simple names or just not do it. And a few years later, I'm watching Dan Rather in the CBS Evening News, and there's a report from Haiti. And who is reporting from Haiti? Art Rascone on the CBS Evening News.
Wow.
Freaked me out. But, you know, and he went on to a fantastic career, won several awards in Spanish TV and journalism while he was in Los Angeles, and he worked for ABC News, and just a fascinating guy, and I'm really proud to have him on the podcast, just like you, Tom, because, hey, we're having fun already, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Well, I was going to ask you, you have worked, just like most of us, everywhere. I mean, radio is very transient, and tell us some of the markets that you did work in.
Yeah, let's see. The college I went to was a little place called Baker University in Baldwin City, Kansas.
Okay.
And to my knowledge, only one famous person has ever come out of there, and that is Mike McCarthy, the former coach of the Green Bay Packers and current coach of the Dallas Cowboys.
Oh, he's famous.
So he's the one.
He's the one. I understand radio, right?
Yeah, right. And I'm the guy who will come in every morning and turn on the transmitter and do the morning show. But then I worked in Lawrence and eventually I got down to the Arkansas side of Texarkana.
Oh, okay.
A little town called Ashdown.
I know where it's at.
Beautiful location. Yeah. Unfortunately, the station no longer exists.
Uh-huh.
And I did the evening show. And if you worked there, you also had to do a little time selling.
Done that too.
And I still remember that's where I got my first ever payment for recording a commercial that was going to air on radio and TV in the Texarkana market.
Oh, cool.
And I remember it was for Souther's Jewelers. And their tagline was, Souther's for a taste of Tiffany.
Well, you know, I worked for a short time in a little community called Stamps, Arkansas, which was near Magnolia. So I'm very familiar with that area, too. So that's, you know, we're finding out a lot about each other. So
I'll tell you what, I got there. I couldn't believe what a beautiful state it was.
Right. And
then I got the call. Oh, yeah. Then I got a call after 7 months to go to the Indianapolis market. And that was interesting. The station sat on the north side of Indianapolis. And it was an AM-FM. And the AM was still in their old location. They were eventually building everything in a new facility right off of I-69. And they had the place was originally going to be a television station. It burned down and the people gave it up. So Eastern Broadcasting bought it out. They put the FM in first and then eventually moved out the AM in the offices. And they had a three-sided self-supporting tower for the FM and then a single stick tower for the daytime or AM.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was told we'd like you to do the afternoon show. And we're kind of like an up-tempo MOR, which in 1975, I said, okay, yes, that's pretty cool. I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I get there, And there's like nothing in there at the time except a very nice studio and production studio. They're still building. And there's nothing but an empty room, a folding table, and two people sitting at it. One was the program director, and the other was his assistant, who was also the all-night guy. And they asked me who I was.
Oh.
I said, I'm Tom. I'm the guy you just hired for the afternoon show. But, oh, we were expecting you tomorrow. So I showed him my letter that told me to be there at such and such a time today. He said, well, what do you know? So we talked a little bit, and let me see if I can clean this up a little bit. He says, well, Tom, you're going to blank a brick, but for the first 2 weeks, we're going to put you on the overnight show while you learn the format. Well, the station was very highly formatted. Every hour, the clock changed.
Oh,
and
man.
sometimes that meant the rules changed. Now, they did do up-tempo contemporary MOR in the afternoon, and that really at night, it almost rocked sometimes at night, but the rest of the time you were playing Ronnie Aldrich and his twin pianos, Mantovani. You know, here's
the Ray Conniff singer, yes.
Oh, yes. There, no real personality. I mean, oh my gosh, I thought, what did I get into? Now, the AM was rocking, it was top 40. But it was a good learning experience for me. And I learned to do a lot of different things. I eventually got onto the AM doing middays, and then they let me do color for sports play-by-play, which was a big money earner for the station.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a very good guy doing the sports announcing and calling the games. He was our morning guy. And we'd drive in his car. And, of course, you remember back in those days, you just didn't set up a Marty or something. I mean, we would have to sometimes climb a pole and hook up to the phone line.
Uh-huh.
And then hope it worked and didn't have to climb the pole again.
And a lot of times it didn't work.
That's right. Uh-huh. Or there was a hum in the line. But I got to see some wonderful young athletes, especially basketball, Indiana being such a big basketball state. And saw some people that went on to major colleges in the NBA. And it was a fun time.
Yeah. So you brought up the 70s and the MOR, and then you said the FM was the MOR station and the AM was the rocker. And around that time was when things started to shift on AM and FM. I remember, you know, WHBQ being the top rock and roll station, and WMPS when they had Rick Dees on both of those stations. And then there was the other stations, Rock 103, that was playing stuff like Frank Zappa, you know. And then as time progressed, you started seeing all the rock music making their way over to the FM. Mm-hmm. So how long did it take before you got that first FM rocker?
Well, I'm trying to think. It was April of 1977. I was still in Indiana. And a friend of mine that I told you about earlier, Buddy, called me up. And he and some friends from St. Louis Radio were taking over a little station in Bloomington Normal, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
The middle of the state, middle of nowhere. And I thought, why should I leave here and go there? But I went to see it, and they sold me on it. They said, Tom, we're going to turn this station around. We're going to have a whole bunch of fun doing it. And I really liked the owner of the station, the general manager. Wonderful man. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, I'll do it. And we were country, and eventually we became top 40. We were still struggling for sponsors. And one day we finally got a pretty sizable buy. It was from the local head shop.
Oh, yeah.
Mandingo's, the store for body and soul.
Oh, I bet.
So our manager, bless his heart, didn't know what he was getting into. And the buy, the owner of Mandingo's wanted to give away bongs on the air. And he agreed to it. And so we had to go to him and say, excuse me, sir, do you know what a bong is? So he said, well, I have to call right away and change this. So the owner, who was a really friendly guy, says, tell you what, can we do Frisbees with our name on it? Sure, what harm is there in that? So we get the box of Frisbees in, and there it is, Mandingo's Store for Body and Soul. Here's our phone number. Here's our address. And in the middle of the Frisbee is a giant marijuana leaf.
Oh. And that era businessman didn't like that.
No, but, well, we went with it. We needed the money.
Yeah. Wow.
So there was a guy who would call me, who heard me on the air there. Every month for 7 months, this man would call me and want me to go work for him. And it was up in the middle of Wisconsin in a little town called Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it on a map and I thought, why in the world would I want to go there? That's ridiculous. And eventually our station changed ownership, and the new owner, who was a good guy, but his idea of the format was Johnny Mathis, Casey and the Sunshine Band, and do a Hog Report.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That works.
Yeah. But you know what? He made money off of that stuff, so he was smart. So anyway, after 7 months of these monthly phone calls, I said, let's talk about it. Well, the programmer's name was Pat Martin. And meeting Pat was one of the best things that ever happened to me in my career. He was a radio programming genius. And he finally talks me into going to this little FM station, which was my first FM rocker. So I'm hauling the old obligatory U-Haul, and I get about an hour south of town. I thought, let's hear the afternoon guy that I'm replacing, see what I'm getting into. First thing that struck me was the quality of the audio. It beat anything I'd heard in any big cities for the most part.
Uh-huh.
Phenomenal. Then I hear the jock. I thought, whoa. Am I good enough to replace this guy? He's really good.
Uh-huh.
And then I heard, you know, the rest of the staff, and I'm going, what are these guys doing in this little town? This station is incredible. Well, I was only there 13 months, and in that time, we were the Billboard Small Market Station of the Year.
Oh, cool.
Pat was the Program Director of the Year. We won some other accolades. The staff just went on to amazing things. I look back at that staff and can't believe the careers they had. One of them was a night guy we hired named Dallas Cole, whose real name is Jeff Rowe. And I mean, he went on to program and manage stations when he was big stations in his 20s.
Whoa.
And ended up working in the early days of AOL and early days of VH1, worked for years for NBC in California. Recently, he produced a movie that did extremely well on Amazon about the rock and roll fantasy camps.
That'd be cool.
And the staff was just loaded with people like this. And Pat eventually got out of there and went to Milwaukee and was very successful. And we still talk. We're still in touch.
Radio Guy Reflections.
Too many people in this business who think that they're, I guess it's a podcast, their stuff doesn't stink. You know, it's just like, hey, look, we're all just enjoying the game. We're all just having a good time. Sports are supposed to be fun. Don't take yourself too seriously. Let's go have a good time and really paint a great picture for the fans out there.
I wanted to be me. I didn't want to put on a show. I wanted to, obviously, a show, but I didn't want to be fake on the air. What you get is what you get.
You know, that would be a fascinating career. I want to witness history in a way and see it and tell the compelling stories of it.
When did you find out he is autistic?
When you get that diagnosis, it's not necessarily a shock to you, but it's validating how you've been feeling.
I can't imagine what the future of talk radio could have been or would have been had Rush not come along when he did.
This is Radio Guy Reflections. Well, you know, I just did a podcast with a former coworker named AJ Knight. He's like 30 years old, and he's getting ready to move to Maine from Utah. And we were talking about his experiences and what got him started. And surprisingly enough, it was through high school at a high school station and moved on wanting to do film, but he kind of fell into radio. And, I mean, he was like, I've worked with these amazing people over the year. And you know, he he and I worked together for about 5 years, off and on, and I'm just amazed at how sometimes people just kind of fall into this career, because I never thought about it as a kid like you did. I kind of fell into it just because of the high school station. But I've really enjoyed my years here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about where you're happy. You know, sometimes you think it's the bigger thing that's going to make you happy, and then you find out it really isn't. It's something else, whether it's the people you work with or the community you're in, and there's just so much to be said for that.
So you traveled all over the country, and you've kind of settled in San Antonio. How did that come about, and how long have you been in San Antonio?
I've been here since September of 2006. I spent the majority of my career in Milwaukee. Got hired at WISN AM back in November of 78. And they had a phenomenal program director there, Bill Garcia, who had just made a big name at 99X in New York and worked in Miami. And I get this call one day saying, "Hey, Tom, we got this opening here. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Absolutely." So I went to Pat and I said, "Pat, I got this call from Bill Garcia. I don't know how he knows about me." He said, "I sent him your tape. You're ready to get out of here."
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
I mean, how many bosses would do something like that?
Not many. Not many at all.
So I drove and we had an interview and it went very well. And he hired me for the 7 to midnight shift on the 50,000-watt AM station. And I'm, 22 years old or something.
Whoa. That's awesome, man.
Gosh. It was kind of funny. It was a great station. We had some more. We had wonderful people who went through there. And we had a TV station affiliated with us, so we would do some cross-promotion. And I noticed when I got there, every year in the week between Christmas and New Year's, somebody would get fired, and it would like alternate between an AM or an FM person. And my third year, guess whose turn it was?
It was your turn.
It was my turn.
That's not cool. Right during the holidays. Ugh.
Oh man. And I was out of work an hour.
Oh, I wish that would have ever happened to me, but never.
I started making some phone calls, and another legendary broadcaster who's since become one of the people in the voiceover world, a man by the name of John Driscoll, who was programming in town. I called him up, and he said, "Yeah, I know who you are." He said, "Set up a time, come in, and we'll talk." And I said, "Okay, I'll bring my stuff with me." He said, No, it's okay. I know how you sound." So we get there, and we really hit it off. And we finished the interview. I said, "Will you do me a favor, just critique my air check a little bit?" He said, "Okay." Throws the cassette in, starts listening to it. His facial expression changes. He says, "Where did you get that?" And what it was an air check I had made of him a couple of years earlier when he was working at WCFL in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And he thought that was so funny that I brought that in.
Ah, it's a small world sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. And then, boy, you talk about another guy, major talent. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And then I eventually went on to a couple other stations in town before getting let go again. And then I got to the creme de la creme of Milwaukee radio, WTMJ.
TMJ.
And for many people, that's a destination radio station.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's AM, FM, which was WKTI, and Channel 4, the NBC affiliate in town. Plus, we were owned by Journal Communications, which had the newspaper, and at the time, two newspapers. So we were the media conglomerate.
Uh-huh.
And that was the place, this is where all the legendary broadcasters were, or had been, outside of maybe WOKY and WEMP. And I mean, I was just in awe. I had gone there once before. They had this huge facility called Radio City. And in front, this big canopy you would drive under with a message board on it and this amazing lobby. And I went there first time in the 80s to record a commercial for somebody. And at that time, this facility still had an actual auditorium from the days of live radio broadcasting with audiences and an orchestra.
Dang.
And I went in there and got to record this commercial. And I'm thinking, this doesn't get much better than this.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, in June of 1990, I get hired there. And I was part-time for a year. And they taught me so many things. I mean, I learned how to produce talk radio. I learned how to do talk radio. I learned more about how to do sports radio, because we were the flagship originating station for the Packers, the Brewers, and the Bucks, and we ran Badger sports as well.
Man, that's a lot of sports to go through in one little area.
It is a lot of income for the station.
Oh, bet.
And I mean, it was just, does it get any better than this? And we did the airborne traffic reports as well. And they asked me in the interview, they said, how do you feel about light airplanes? I said, I'm a pilot. And they're like, really? And they had me learning that. And eventually that person quit. And that became my full-time job, morning and afternoon, on both radio and TV.
Uh-huh.
And did that for 17 years. And the split shifts are not fun.
Oh, no, no, they're not fun. Because yeah, you feel like you are working all day long.
Right.
Yeah.
The good thing is I got a lot of, you know, most holidays off. I got most weekends off. Not during the Packer season, because we would do traffic for a lot of the Packer games in Green Bay. And so that meant some travel for that, which was fun. I eventually got to the point, you know, I got to stay up there during the games and see the games.
Uh-huh.
And then as they started building on to Lambeau, I got to sit inside, which was nice.
Yes, that's even better. So were the Packers any good at that time? Because they, you know, they were so good in the 60s and 70s. And then they, you know, they were kind of mediocre. And then every once in a while they'd be okay until around Brett Favre. What was the era that you were doing stuff for the Pack?
Right. We used to have a saying at the time. When the Packers have another mediocre or less than mediocre season, we would say, well, there's always the Bucks.
And you've had some good teams there, too.
Oh, yeah, especially during the Don Nelson years.
Oh,
and then,
yeah.
You know, winning the NBA championship last year with Giannis. Very exciting.
Yeah.
One of my things that I would do, I would run the network broadcast for the Packer games.
Uh-huh.
So that meant feeding local and network stations, and it would get, you would have to really be on top of it because everything had to match.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, they don't do it anymore, but at halftime, they would take listener questions.
Ooh.
And so I had to get into a 7-second time delay, line up the questions, all the way while running the board and making sure the locals and everybody got their correct commercials. And then Jim Irwin, who at the time was the Packer play-by-play person, would take the calls. Then afterwards, you have to get out of the delay, make sure everything matched up time-wise perfectly again, and get into the third quarter.
All with the time delay.
Yes, with getting in and out of it. It was a learning experience. I mean, you would literally sit there and sweat. Well, one day during the early days of the Gulf War, during the second quarter, and it was a great idea. And Jim says, you know what? We were always on the Armed Forces Radio Network.
Okay.
He said, let's only take calls from people who are stationed in the Middle East. So if you're listening from the Middle East, call the studio at this number and we'll call you back and have you on at halftime. Well, now I'm really panicking. Like, how am I going to do all of this? And it worked out beautifully.
Wow.
We got so many great calls on the air. And, of course, the big problem is, you know, by the halftime, you'd have to try to hope you didn't get some people going, they got to get rid of a quarterback. He stinks.
Yeah, there would be a little bit of imbibing going on around Milwaukee and all that area. It's a beer area. Beer and cheese.
And I was running the board for the Packers the day that Brett Favre came in for the very first time and threw the winning touchdown against the Bengals.
That's awesome.
And I was screaming my head off, and I almost missed the cue to the commercial.
And that happens too, but not more than once. So
that's right. It was a very tight ship.
Well, I got to tell you about Milwaukee, that when I was at WYNK in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, we had a caller that we call just about every day, and you know, everyone would make not fun of him, but we would talk to him because his name was Wally, and he had a very distinctive accent. And whenever he would call and say, "Hi, it's Wally," we go, "Wally from Wisconsin," and we make we had so much fun with that guy. So Milwaukee, even though I was in Baton Rouge, it was part of our show in Baton Rouge. That's unreal, man.
It is.
And were you there? Were you in Milwaukee during the era of Lou Alcindor before he went to the Lakers, or was that before you?
No, that was before my time.
Oh, okay, so yeah. Yeah, some great sports in Milwaukee. They've had some great baseball teams.
It's a great sports town. I mean, it's really not that big of a city. And it's been, you know, population-wise, it's lost over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
If you don't mind the winters, it's still just a wonderful, wonderful place to raise a family and live.
And, of course,
the lakefront is beautiful. It's an easy city to get around.
Oh, really?
Oh, wonderful local restaurants. I just love Milwaukee.
And my favorite TV show is
Chicago. You know, it's 90 miles away.
Yeah, and my favorite TV show was supposedly based in Milwaukee, Laverne and Shirley. One of my all time. I even have a copy of the album Lenny and the Squigtones. That's my claim.
Oh my gosh.
It's hanging up in my comic book room right now. So I just was a big fan of that show. So
the building that was supposed to be on the show, the Schatz Beer Tower, was actually the Schlitz Beer Tower.
Oh, Schlitz Beer, yeah.
And unfortunately, that was torn down a few years ago.
Oh.
Now, one of the saddest stories I ever covered there, probably the saddest, while I was doing the airborne traffic, and they were building the new stadium, which was to become Miller Park,
right,
which is now American Family Field. And it was a year away from opening. It was supposed to open in 2000. And they had this huge crane brought in from Germany.
Oh,
I've never seen anything this big in my life. They called it Big Blue. And I remember flying over the stadium going, man, it's so windy. I can't believe they're putting up these roof sections today. They used to call it doing a pick.
Yeah.
And I gotten just about 2 or 3 miles west of there. And one of the monitors in the airplane was the sheriff's office, because part of my job was helping the sheriff's deputies with the freeway patrol, letting them know where accidents were, what lanes were closed, and so on. It's great fun. And I hear the dispatcher say, "We got a report of a roof collapse at Miller Park." And I looked over my shoulder, and all I could see was smoke and dust in the air. So I get the airplane there right away. We had this little button in the airplane that would signal the studio that something was wrong and we needed to go on immediately. So I hit that button and we went on and I started breaking the story about what happened. Eventually, it turned out 3 people were killed in this accident. And it delayed the stadium for a year. And after about an hour of this, we came up by the top of the hour and they said, "Tom, would you please do us a favor and just do the story from the very beginning? You are now live on the BBC.
Oh.
Well, you know, the smart aleck of me just wanted to go, "Thank you. There's a problem going on here." But I didn't do it, you know. Kept it professional.
I remember when that happened because, you know, I'm a big sports fan, big baseball fan with the Cardinals. And they had a big rivalry going on about that time. And you were basically a witness to this tragedy that occurred in sports. That's incredible. That's, I just put my hat off to you. I don't know if I could handle making a report that spontaneous. But I guess your training comes into play then, doesn't it?
It does. And about every 5 years on the anniversary, I'll get a call and they'll ask me to go on and record a story with them and recount it. And then last year I started getting notes from people saying, "Tom, you know, they're playing you on a news promo."
Without paying me.
I'm sitting here in my home studio now and on my wall, I have a giant framed picture of the final opening day at Milwaukee County Stadium and Miller Park sitting behind it.
That's incredible. Closest I ever came to that was I was at a concert in St. Louis, right outside of St. Louis, a Guns N' Roses concert that broke out into a riot that's pretty famous called the Riverport Riot.
Axl Rose.
And I actually called a little report in to the Missouri Network, and it went from the Missouri Network to KMOX and from KMOX to CBS. But I didn't do anything live. I just did a little phoner, and it just kind of bounced around. I had people, friends of mine from St. Louis, calling me about that. But, yeah, that's the closest I ever came, so.
Yeah. Did he give you any strength money for that? Or?
Are you kidding me? This is radio. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, when I was with the Missouri Network, when I was owning the radio station, I was actually doing the morning show. I was the newsman, did a little sales, did sports. You know, I did everything because it was such a small town. But I actually won the Newsman of the Month award 6 times when I was in Missouri. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's my claim to fame. It's like the Buckeye Newshawk Award, you know?
Yeah.
Which I also got one of those as a gift one time, a gag gift. But anyway, when you mentioned WKRP, and I actually had a friend that I knew in Idaho that was from Georgia, and she eventually worked at the real WKRP in Marietta, Georgia for about 2 years. But I think they changed their call letters by now. But that show was so influential to show people how radio really was. I mean, you always had all these great personalities, and it seemed like every station had a Herb Tarlick. Every station had a Dr. Johnny Fever. I just remember when I would talk to people about radio, said it was so real. It was so truthful. Those guys did a wonderful job in putting that TV program together.
And, you know, CBS every year tried to find an excuse to cancel that show.
Uh-huh.
And they kept hanging in there, which was amazing because they would always change their night and time slot.
Uh-huh.
And there's some great interviews on YouTube with, I'm drawing a blank now, Hugh, the guy who put it together.
Uh-huh.
I'm drawing a blank on his last name.
Me too.
But he goes into some great detail on that and how it all worked that you would find interesting.
I just remember when that Who concert happened in Cincinnati that killed all those young people.
And
the program that WKRP did after that, and then the tornado that hit in downtown Cincinnati, which was kind of based on fact. And I just thought it was a wonderful show. And when you mentioned WKRP, I just was like, oh man, I remember that show. And you know, of course, the famous turkey episode.
Oh yeah,
that was. And I actually had a friend that had a very similar experience in Idaho. But they had frozen turkeys they were throwing off from the roof of a building in Rigby, Idaho. Can you imagine throwing a 20-pound frozen turkey at people? I said, what in the he said, yeah, it was a mistake. So
did anybody get hurt?
Nobody got hurt, surprisingly enough. And somebody jumped up and grabbed one right before it went through a plate glass window.
Oh, my gosh.
It's such a great industry. Tell us about maybe some stunts that you were with, or maybe you saw at some of the radio station, because stunt radio was so big in the 60s and 70s, doing stunts.
Well, I did a great one in Bloomington, Normal, Illinois. I forget what charity we were raising some money for, and they were having a carnival. And I said, you know what? I will sit for 2 hours in the dunk booth. And to make it even more interesting, I said, I will wear a skin diving outfit. And I'll wear it during my midday show, and I'll wear it in the diving booth. Well, I've never been diving in my life. I had no reason to expect anything. So we got a local shop who did a trade, of course.
Of course.
And of course, I'm sitting there in this radio studio wearing this rubber wetsuit, getting tighter and tighter and tighter all day. Oh. Never dawned on me that, this thing's supposed to be wet. Somehow made it out there, and I was so thankful every time I got dunked in the water.
Hallelujah. I did that one time, and they didn't have it quite set up right, and it was set up on concrete, and I actually fell wrong and broke my Cossack's bone.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I broke my butt, you know. So that happened in Montgomery City, Missouri. And I still went another hour. I gutted it out.
Yep.
There were some great things about radio back in those days. I mean, you had great talent going through. You got to meet some incredible people. You talked about being in the studio or being at the game when Brett Favre came through the Green Bay Packers. At radio and when we did what we did, we also had the opportunity to meet celebrities. Was there any bigger celebrities that you got to meet?
A lot of music stars, especially when I was working in country music at WMIL, which is a great station. But the one that excited me the most, you know, after a while, you don't get too excited.
All right.
But, you know, being a pilot and being a person who just grew up loving the space program, I got to meet Jim Lovell a couple of times.
Oh, cool.
The first time he was in our TV station recording an interview show, and I saw him in there, and I said, hey, can I go in there and finish watching? He said, sure, come on in. And afterwards, I went and talked to him, got his autograph. And that one just really stood out to me. And being the big station that it was, I mean, you never knew who you would see in there. One day, I'm just walking around the corner going from TV to radio, and I almost bumped right into Billy Dee Williams face-to-face.
Cool.
I apologized. He said, can you please show me where the bathroom is?
Sure, Landau. Here we go.
Another time I'm sitting at my desk doing some prep work, and here comes former New York Mayor Koch in. I said, oh, Mayor, can I help you? So I'm here just looking around. How you doing? Just stood there, talked to me for about 5 minutes.
That's awesome.
Went on.
Well, you know, you talked about, you know, working at a country radio station. I've had this conversation with a couple of people about country musicians. Most of them are pretty much down to earth, just nice people. But sometimes when you get on the rock and roll side, it was a little bit different. Did you ever find that?
I did. I didn't meet as many of the rock and roll people as I did the country people.
Right.
And we used to introduce all the big country acts in town, which was so much fun.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when Kenny Rogers was at his peak, and he sold out the big arena downtown, and we had a wonderful promotion department, and our programming was excellent, and we were not going to let our competition get a foot in the door. And we went and hired a bunch of great-looking models. Man, I get away with this today.
Uh-huh.
Put them all in our T-shirts. We had every door to that arena covered with our models, our T-shirts, giving out bumper stickers. We had our signage everywhere you looked.
That's great.
And I didn't see this happen. I heard it secondhand, but I heard that the competition showed up, took one look, and drove away.
You know, that brings up an important part of radio that sometimes some stations do very well and others don't, is visibility. And, you know, billboards are so important to radio, making sure that your promos are just incredible on the air. And then your bumper stickers, T-shirts, your little giveaways when you're out doing your remote broadcast. And it's all visual. And that's the one visual portion of especially smaller town radio that I think they really drop the ball on, because sometimes that stuff can get a little bit expensive to get those promotional things going.
And one of the things we used to tie in with every year in Milwaukee was what was called West Dallas Western Days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge event. We were always in the parade and everything. But one of the things they would have was this traveling rodeo called the Wanago Rodeo. And one year they said, hey, Tom, well, my on-air name, it's the only time I think I didn't use my real name.
Right.
I was called the Bandit.
Ooh.
They said, hey, Bandit, would you like to do something for us Friday night at the rodeo? I thought they wanted me to introduce an act or something. And no, they wanted me to ride a bull. Are you nuts? They said, well, come here and take a look. Well, it turned out to be a really old bull. It had one horn missing. So I thought, okay, I'll take one for the team here. So, but even though it was moving slowly, you had to shift, learn how to shift your weight on this thing.
Uh-huh.
Like I learned, if the bull's left front leg went forward, I wanted to lean backwards to my right. So you're always counterbalancing. Well, one of our salespeople had just gotten a new camera and a big telephoto lens, was playing with it. He said, Tom, I'm going to get pictures. I said, great, great. Well, he gets the pictures back, and I wish I had them today. Well, he wasn't quite competent with the camera yet, and everything was blurred.
Oh,
which was, it was great. It made it look like I was really riding a bull.
Like you were doing it, baby, with your arm up in the air and everything, huh?
Me. Yeah, I did that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, a bull story from Arkansas days. We were going to do a newspaper ad because we had rebranded the station and gotten, you know, just completely revamped the station altogether. So the general manager, this he pretty good guy and knew his stuff. He sets up for us to get in front of this great big old huge bull and take a picture with the air staff, all of us cowboy hats and all that. Well, I had the girl that was doing afternoon drive for us, and then I had one of the office staff next to me, and that bull decided to relieve himself. And I am standing there with these two girls draped all over me, and I couldn't do anything. Ruined a good pair of shoes. All over me, and they wouldn't even let me in the van to get back to station. I had to find another way home. Yeah, I had forgotten until you started talking about the bull. Thanks for bringing up a bad memory, Tom.
Yeah, I do what I can.
Well, let's move on to San Antonio, because I talked to Steve Kerr, and he told me that you guys had worked together before, and he talked about San Antonio and radio altogether. Well, what got you into San Antonio?
I have some personal reasons, mm-hmm. and I had made four trips here and decided I liked it. So I got here, and eventually I got hired part-time at Cox Radio, and they were so good to me. And they found work for me on and off the air to keep me busy. And eventually, like I said, they had me open up the traffic department, and I would fill in doing the morning news. And it was a lot of fun. I would do on-air work on Kono, did the weekend remotes. And that's where I met Stephen O'Sellers. And today, we're still great friends. We had breakfast this morning. Yesterday, he and I and another guy were recording some music together. And the people here have been very kind to me. So, having never lived in an area like this, it's been a culture change. I mean, just trying to pronounce names the way they pronounce them here, and not try to sound like I'm too out of touch. And when I first started there, I mean, I was always being corrected on the pronunciation of names.
And, you know, but you probably learned from that too, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad people didn't let it slide because, you know, the way they pronounce the name here, especially Hispanic name, may be different from the way they do it in Indiana or Ohio or Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And even Los Angeles, I would find differences. So, you know, you have to get on those things. And the staff was always so nice to me about correcting me and helping me with these things.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very important, I think sometimes that as we get into some of the bigger markets and some of the stuff that, you know, we're a little bit more into our career, we forget that there are changes from market to market. Here in Salt Lake City, I'm in Logan, Utah, but in Salt Lake City, they'll come in and they'll mispronounce a town, a little area called Manaway. It's spelled Mantua. And then one called Tremonton, and they call it Tremonton. But the hardest one I had was when I was working in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and also in Central Louisiana. There was a friend of mine, his last name was Rico, R-I-C-A-U-D. He pronounced it Rico. And he was the salesman at the radio station I was working at. A couple of months later, I'm moving on to W-Y-N-K, and I'm doing overnights. And there was a, you know, congratulations to one of our contest winners, spelled his name the same way. And I said, Rico, 70 miles difference. It was Ricard. Somebody called and chewed me out. So I appreciate these guys took the time to help you out with that. I think that that's probably a lesson to learn for just about anybody that's in broadcasting at this time, is keep your eyes and ears open for the new guys, because they don't know. It's hard to do going from town to town.
Well, you may have noticed this too. Where I heard that the most was in St. Louis, where people would struggle with the French names.
Right. Yeah, that was tough in the St. Louis area. And then they called Sody, not soda, not Coke, not pop. It was Sody. And it used to drive me nuts listening to a Cardinal game. Even to this day, if I'm watching on TV, I can hear one of the guys barking in the background, "Get your ice cold Sody." Here I'm going, "What the heck is a Sody, man?" But that's true. You know, you go into an area and things are called different. There's different names for different items. Sody, Coke. When I was growing up, everything was a Coke in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what it is in Texas, you know, but it's, you know, it changes everywhere you go.
Down here, it's a soda unless you specifically say you want a Big Red.
Oh, good stuff. Big Red. Yeah, that's,
when I moved to Milwaukee, when I moved to Milwaukee, I thought I would never learn to pronounce Manitowoc.
Oh, that would be a tough one.
I don't
know
why that one gave me such a hard time when other ones didn't.
Uh-huh.
I look at it and go, Manitowoc.
So you've had that experience, you know, going from, you know, a lot in the Midwest and then going up north, you know, when, you know, the accents changes and now you're in an area with San Antonio. Now you can go just about any place and pronounce most things, right?
I try. The biggest thing even to this day is trying to not have a Wisconsin accent.
Oh.
It's something I work on daily. It's from living there so long.
And the
people there, I mean, I still hear from listeners and people. They just treated me so well. I mean, I just what a welcoming community.
Oh, I love that. I'd love to go there one day, but you know, it's a long way
don't
from
go after
Utah.
October. Yeah.
Oh, really?
No, not unless you like crummy weather.
Well, you know, being from Tennessee, I grew up in Memphis. I had a pretty bad Southern accent, and actually, when I started in high school, a guy named Joe Dreyer was the head of the program. He set me in a little room with a cassette recorder and had me reading a first grade reader with a lot of the words like I, mine, five, anything with the letter I in it. Southerners go, I, mine, five. And I can still slip into a pretty good, you know, dadgum Southern accent, you know, and talk like, you know, I'm one of them rednecks from back in Tennessee. And because that's where I'm from. I'm a redneck from Tennessee. I actually used that a little bit on the air because everybody knew I was from Tennessee with some of the stuff I would do. When I would say goodbye in the morning, I'd always say, bye-bye, toodaloo, y'all. And people to this day, they'll say, I remember you saying, bye-bye, toodaloo, y'all. Had a handyman over the other day talked about that. It's just something that, you know, if you're having trouble with it, play with it, get rid of it. If you can't get rid of it, just make your best with it, right?
No, that's a wonderful idea. I mean, even today, if I'm getting ready to record, one of the warm-ups I will do is I would just do phonetically go through all the vowels.
Oh, yeah.
And do them in different ways. And it helps me anyway.
So when you were in San Antonio and you get to meet Stephen O. Sellers and all the other guys that you have breakfast with every week, how many stations did you wind up working at in San Antonio?
Well, I only worked at Cox Radio. I'm trying to think how many stations we had, 6 or 7. And there were AM and FM and formats all over the place. And what was really fun was when I would fill in doing the morning news. Especially with the FM morning show. And they had a ton of different people going through there during the morning show. But they were all wonderful. And we would actually get to banter back and forth and do a little personality, which was great. I look so forward to it.
That's what makes radio radio to me, is when you get people that are actually liking each other and talking to each other and joking with each other. That to me is what radio, when it's at its best, is when it's that one-on-one communication, even if it's between a newsman and one or two people that, you know, are the main voices. That to me is what I enjoyed about radio and doing my air shift that I had to do for the last, 2002 to 2021, I was basically by myself, and I struggled to do personality radio with just by myself because I couldn't get the listeners to really call in very much. It was always the same people that would call, same person, same people always telling me what they thought, and I just kind of got tired of that and finally just decided to be myself on the radio and talk about what entertained me a little bit more, and it really took off the last few years of my career.
That's great.
Yeah.
I remember when I first started at WTMJ, and for a while they put me on the overnight shift, which was still live.
Right.
Starting at midnight. And we did, you know, the top of the hour network news and the local news. And the way this board was set up as a talk station was the phone banks were right down the middle of the board, which I thought was phenomenal.
Right.
So we come out of the news, I said my hellos, set up a subject. Every phone line was lit up. It's like 9 or 10 phone lines.
Right.
I'm thinking, it's midnight and people are actually calling here. I can't believe this.
Right.
We had a legendary afternoon guy there, Jonathan Green.
Yeah.
And he used to call us the biggest stick in the state. And
he was absolutely
correct.
Uh-huh.
Jonathan, what another major talent. Oh, he was incredible. Talk about wonderful personality radio. Did you play records in your career? Play actual records?
Oh yeah, my first shift by myself at WQOX, the high school station in Memphis, by myself, nobody else in the control room, was "Carefree Highway" by Gordon Lightfoot. So what did I do? I turned it off right in the middle of the song because I was getting ready to cue up another record. So then I turned it back on. Yep. And then I took the needle off the thing and then had to put it back. Yes, I got 45s, records. Then we went into the cards and CDs, and now everything's on computers.
When I was in Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, you remember what this was like. You'd look forward to a 4, 4.5 minute song so you could make that little trip up the hall.
Yeah.
So one day I'm playing Rod Stewart's Maggie May.
Yep.
Finally, I get back and I see all four of the phone lines ringing. I thought, what's going on? Nobody calls this radio station. So I turned up the monitor and the record had been stuck.
Oh.
And it was stuck where Rod was singing, "Mother, what a lover, mother, what a lover."
That is awesome. Yeah, imagine that. I imagine some listeners were, but you know, you get that song, 4, 4.5 minutes long, and you learn to take care of business, as they say, pretty quick. When I was at KODJ in Salt Lake City doing overnights, the program director would often listen to the radio to make sure people were following the format. And I was always one to make sure that I was playing the songs that, you know, they put out on the log for me, make sure everything's going on. I remember telling him one time, I said, if you ever hear Ike and Tina Turner, "Proud Mary," you know what I'm doing. because that was the longest song we had, and it was only 4:49, and then the restroom was not close to the studio. I'll tell you that. I did play it a few times. So those were the fun days, though. You know, you wound up finding ways to take care of things, I guess they could say. So we've all seen all these changes. What's with the changes over the years from playing records and to more of the computer-based programming. What was the best thing that you see as it's coming out in radio, how it has improved radio, and then maybe the one thing that makes it difficult to do?
Well, the one thing I liked was the fact that with voice tracking, you wouldn't have to come in on a holiday.
Right.
And to me, that was wonderful. Uh-huh. The downside of that is everybody's a part-time worker for the most part. And
right.
You don't get to do a whole lot.
Yeah, and there's no...
I just... there's just, there are some exceptions in every market, especially on morning shows.
Right.
But for the most part, if I'm a young person, I'm not hearing anything to get me excited to go into radio.
Right. I agree.
And that makes me sad. I mean, it literally makes me sad when I think of the fun we had and historical events. I mean, it was just a matter of timing. I was in the newsroom standing next to the teletype. We remember those.
Oh, yeah.
On two momentous occasions, one announcing Elvis had died.
Uh-huh.
And I took that straight to the studio. And the second announcing John Lennon had been shot.
Wow.
Now, you got that right on the air.
Huh.
And of course, remembering all the ink.
There's something about doing that kind of thing that just sticks in your mind, that you were actually part of the story because you got to tell people about it, and it just became part of your story because of that story, wasn't it?
Yes, and in the case of the John Lennon assassination, that was the night of my first wedding anniversary.
Ooh.
I called my wife and I said, well, change of plans, I may be home around 6 a.m.
yeah,
as the program director came in and we were putting together songs and tributes and different things, and but you know what, I wouldn't, the tragedy aside,
right,
I mean, I wouldn't trade being a part of that and doing my little bit for anything.
Right. And were you working news when 9/11 happened?
Actually, I was doing the traffic, mm-hmm. and I had just finished a radio report, and I had my TV monitor on, getting ready to go on to Channel 4, and radio broke into it first.
Mm-hmm.
And the TV station was running the Today Show, which was on an hour delay.
Right.
And I'm literally screaming, break away, break away.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Now, what was interesting about that is they let us stay in the air. They were, of course, closing the airport. And when I landed, there was a small government jet there. And they said, do you see that jet? And it had, you know, the blue and white markings and all. I said, yes. They said, he's going to follow you to the ramp. Well, as it turns out, John Ashcroft was on that jet.
Oh, yeah.
And he was in town for some kind of engagement. And they followed us there. And I had an office on the third floor of a hangar there. And I went to go downstairs into the main lobby as signature flight support, and they wouldn't let me in. And I have red ramp pass to get on the ramp, but you won't let me in. Come to find out later, the reason why was in one of the rooms there were George and Barbara Bush.
Woo.
And they were on their way to Minneapolis when they, it matters the next president, you're landing.
Oh.
And they had them and all the Secret Service people in there. So I had to stay up in my office till 12 or 1 o'clock that day before they said, okay, you can leave.
And it was so hard to make those reports. Did you find yourself getting emotional or emotionally involved in the story? Or was it just that you had the opportunity to do something to help inform your community?
You know, the emotions really hit me later, mm-hmm. especially as I was working from home and my daughter came home from school and giving her a big hug. And I remember telling her, I said, she was 11 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I said, our world is never going to be the same.
Right.
And of course, I didn't expect her to understand that. But,
right. But
that was amazing. And I lived where right along the final approach path to the airport. So I'm used to planes all day and all the time.
Right.
And the quiet was just so amazing. I go out walking the dogs and it was just quiet.
It was an amazing time. At the station I was working at, I was doing mornings, but I was also, I had some rookies. I mean, basically people just starting radio that didn't understand how to go about things. So I'm barking out orders to, you know, for the news person to contact the local people, trying to get that local angle about what's going on at the airport here, contacting the University of Utah State to see, you know, maybe getting a professor to talk to us about something. And then I got a telephone call from my sister in Tennessee because my other sister was actually in New York City with her son, just a few miles away from the World Trade Center, getting medical tests for a genetic disease. And we didn't know where they were for like 24 hours, but I just remember the emotions I was going through. I basically had to block it out because every time I'd think of my sister and my nephew, I'd almost lose it. And it was it was an incredible time, but also I've talked to several people in radio about this. I think that we as an industry really kicked it up a notch to serve our communities and help people deal with the situation of 9/11. It was an incredible time.
It really was. You know, another major story, totally different. This morning I took off to do the morning traffic reports. Beautiful summer morning. And all of a sudden these news stories start coming in about some guy named Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, okay.
So I end up circling around where his apartment building was and looking at these news trucks and all. I'm going, and of course, as the morning goes on, the story just kept getting more and more bizarre.
Oh, wow. And you were reporting on that from the airplane?
About what was going on in that neighborhood, right, where streets were blocked.
Oh, well, yeah. That had to be something, knowing how strange that story was. You've had an incredible career, Tom. I'm just happy to talk to you about this. This has been awesome, man.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time and popping some memories back into my head, some of which I'd forgotten about. And I for 39 years, I was an extremely lucky person.
Mm-hmm. You did a 39-year career then?
I did.
Wow. I was more of a 45 years. Actually, wow. For me, yeah, I just lost my job last February, and I had started in high school and worked all over the country. But it was an incredible industry that still can be incredible, but with all the changes in technology, and I hesitate saying that it's making radio less relevant, because I don't think radio has really found their niche in what this new technology is really bringing about, because of the dollar signs, you know, voice trackers working part-time.
Once somebody discovers there's something people want to hear, and I don't care if it's AM or FM, over on the internet, all of it, somebody's really going to latch on to something.
Right.
And then, of course, everybody will copy it.
And that's what consultants do, right? They copy everything.
That was a... Oh, you brought up a great...
Let's talk consultants. I love talking consultants.
We had... Actually, a guy was a very good consultant when I was at PMJ. And in the early 90s, we're trying to come up with a new name for the morning show, because we're kind of changing the format of the morning news program.
Right.
So we're sitting in this conference room, and I forget how many of us were in there, and we had the telephone thing sitting in the middle of the table so we could listen and lean in and talk. And we're talking to the consultant in California, and we were trying to come up with a name for the show, and just nothing was working, absolutely nothing. And people are ready to give up, and there's this pause. And I said, I think I have a solution. Like, yes, yes, yes. And I'm thinking very Milwaukee. I said, we'll call it News for Use. Well, that's the reaction all around the table.
Oh.
And when the laughter dies down, the consultant says, I don't get it.
He wasn't familiar. Oh, my word.
Which made us laugh even harder.
Uh-huh. Well, I had somebody thrown onto me as being my partner when I was at the Country Giant here in Logan. And a nice guy, and he called himself Cowboy Ted. So I'm just Dave Denton. That's who I am. I've always wanted to be who I am. And we're trying to think of a name for, you know, Dave and Ted and all whatever. And he came up to me and says, you know, Dave, I've got the name for our morning show. I said, what's that, Ted? The Barnyard Buddies. And I said, no way in hell am I going to be a Barnyard Buddy. So I don't know if he was trying to be funny, but I don't think he was, because he was a unique individual, let's just say that. And you brought up a point about somebody latching on to something. And that made me think of when I was looking for work and I just moved to Utah. And I was doing some part-time in Salt Lake City for KODJ and for Call AM. And still looking for that full-time gig. And there was a country station that was in a little community called Roy, Utah, which is north of Ogden. And they had 100,000 watts, so they got into Salt Lake City very well. And I remember going there and interviewing and thinking I had a good chance for that job. But before I went in, I was talking to the program director at a station called KCAT in Salt Lake City, and they were pretty hot at the time. And he says, I just don't know what to do about my nights. And I said, what do you mean? He says, there's a station in Roy, and he gave me the name of it, and I can't remember what it is now. But he said, they're doing an all-request show from 6 until midnight. And they were kicking it in Salt Lake City. And here's this program director at the other time frames doing very well. He couldn't understand why this all-request show was being so popular. And I kept on saying to him, maybe people want to be able to hear the songs they want to hear, not what you want them to hear. And he went, but they never changed. And a couple of years later, that station was sold to a big conglomerate. And now it's off the air. But they were kicking it at night with that just all-request show, doing very, very well.
Wow.
Yeah. And maybe something like that's going to have to happen, where somebody takes a chance, especially in a music format, to take a chance and do it right. Because taking requests can also be very iffy. You get the same calls all the time. And then they want to request it. They want it. Why didn't you play it then within 20 minutes? Well, you had a log of an hour worth of songs ahead of them, and they just don't understand that. So it's kind of iffy when I mention that. But there are different things that I think people just haven't thought of as of yet, and how to get involved in how technology and social media is really kind of helping out the radio industry, but also it's hurting it a little bit. And it's been fascinating talking to you about the good old days, you know, that they say. Everybody talks about the good old days, but in radio, they really were, because we got to be creative, we got to be fun, and we got to meet some incredible, incredible people. And I appreciate you talking to me, man.
Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate you.
Oh, well, we're just an appreciation society here. But you know, honestly, and I've talked to Steve O'Sellers, and I've talked to a couple other people, AC Cantu down in the San Antonio area, and the thing that I enjoyed the most talking to radio people is hearing similar stories, but also stories that absolutely are surprising. I just talked to the young man I told you about that is leaving to go to Maine, leaving Utah. And we talked about how he had been on the air and told a very personal story about a dark time in his life. And he wrote a blog about it and did a little podcast that they did all about it. And the response he got from others, other listeners, people that listened to VFX, and how it affected them to know somebody else was going through the same thing. Sometimes I think we as radio people underestimate the influence we can have on our listeners. And I think you have shown that being personal and being professional at the same time has really affected not only you, but those around you. And it's just been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been fun to think about some of these things again and share the stories.
And aren't we all just storytellers?
Yes.
That's what we do. I wrote up a little kind of a booklet right after I lost my job and talked about storytelling being so important in this industry. And that's where the liner cards have kind of ruined it for us. So you've had to do a few liner cards in your day, I bet.
It is, but I enjoyed the stations where they would let you work around the liner card and have some personality and some fun with it instead of just reading it word for word. You know, make the liner card interesting. So, it, you know, otherwise it gets boring to the listener as well.
It does. It does. I worked at a station in Columbia that, and I was just doing fill-in. Then eventually I started doing their nights for about a year. But during that year and a half that I worked for them, they never changed their liner card throughout every hour. It was the same liner card at the same position every hour. Never changed
it. Oh, my gosh.
Not one time for a year and a half. And they were being consulted by a big consultant. I kid you not, they never changed it in a year, year and a half. And I got to meet that guy and told him, he says, well, I never told him to do that. I said, well, that's what they were doing. So, anyway.
One of my favorite liner card stories, place I was working, I was interim PD there two or three times. Mm-hmm. And one thing I discovered anytime I was a program director or interim is I didn't really like it. I like being a music director. I like being a system program director, but I was an on-air guy and production. So anyway, one of the times I'm the interim program director, I get a call about 2:33 in the morning from the all-night guy. He said, Tom, I've got a problem. I said, well, it must be serious. What is it? Well, one of the liner cards, you know, the blue ones? I said, yeah. I said, well, it slipped down between the pot and the board, between the sliders. I don't know what to do. I said, do you remember what it said? Yeah. I said, okay, jot that down. And does the slider still work? Is everything okay? Yeah. I said, all right, we'll talk to the engineer in the morning and he'll take it apart and take the card out. So I think you'll be okay.
That's where we get to sometimes when you get those liner cards, you're kind of afraid to veer off of it. And you're right. If you had that liner card and you could use that as an example, or maybe as just something to get your creative juicing flowing, that's when it worked. When you just had to read it exactly. I wasn't too thrilled doing that. And I had to do that several times in my career too. Well, Tom,
bless his heart, you know, he was just doing the best he knew how to do. And, you know, and it was a good thing that he called me and asked me about it.
And that's true. That's true.
By the way, very quickly, you've got a picture on your website of a station that I had to blow that picture up to make sure it wasn't someplace I worked.
Really?
It looked so much the same.
Uh-huh.
And when I was in Milwaukee and I was at this FM and they said, you know what, we're going to do something with the AM so you can stay here doing middays, or if you want, you can go on to this AM, do afternoons, and we're going to rock this thing hard with oldies from the 60s and early 70s.
Cool.
And it was a risk, huge risk.
Yeah.
But they put us in a little building like that in the middle of a cornfield with the four tower transmitter site.
Right.
Hundreds of yards off the main road away from anything. And we had so much fun out there.
Uh-huh.
There was nobody to bother you. It was just you, the transmitter, and a bathroom that had no heat or air conditioning.
That was KRXK in Rexburg, Idaho, I bet. And yeah, we had a lot of fun out there. And they actually got that because of the Teton Dam flood that it hit in 1976. And the government put that trailer out there in the middle of a field. And the last time I was up there, that building was getting ready to be demolished, and it just made me want to cry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but that's okay. Hey, you know what? Tell people your website in case they want to check you out, because you've got some great voice work on there. I was looking at that earlier today. Tell them your website.
Well, thank you very much. It's Tom Carr, C-A-R-R,
mm-hmm.
but it's Tom Carr, TXVO.com.
Mm-hmm. TexasVoiceover.com, TXVO. Mm-hmm. I was checking it out right before we went on the air, and you've got such a wonderful set of pipes.
Well, thank you.
I wish my voice was as deep and clear as yours, but mine's more melodic, and I'm just kind of a goof, you know. So, but I was really impressed at some of the work you did. That medical narration, I was going, I hope I never get that kind of job. That would just drive me nuts.
I'll tell you what, some of those things I spend half the time just trying to learn how to pronounce it correctly. And then I'm still not sure.
Yeah. And might have to go back and do it again. So
that's right. But if you got to do it, you do it.
Well, Tom Carr, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Guy Reflections. I think I told you that if we win an hour, great. If we win an hour and a half, even better. And we've gone an hour and a half, and I think we've shared some good stories. And I am just so pleased to be able to get to know you a little bit. And your breakfast club that you meet with every Wednesday, I've talked to most of them, got telephone calls into the other ones, and hope to get them on soon. So I appreciate what you have done for me, and plus getting to make a new friend. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty. So what I've got here is
a lot of editing.
Well, yeah. Not much. It'll be fine. I've got this other one that I did yesterday with this guy that's getting ready to leave Utah that I'm going to put him on probably tomorrow, and then I'll wait about a week, and then I'll put yours on at that time.
Oh,
and,
thank you.
And then I'll send you a link to it. We're available on Spotify, Google Podcast, Pocket Cast, just about any major podcast platform, except for iTunes. You can't get on iTunes anymore, so because of the conglomerate BS and all that. Mm-hmm. But it's been more than a pleasure, and I just love talking to people about radio and their experiences. And you had some great ones there. I mean, I didn't know about Milwaukee, and I, you know, when you're talking the Packers, the Bucks, and the Brewers, I used to follow them all the time. So it was good stuff.
It's an amazing sports town. How a town of that size supports their teams. I mean, even when the Brewers would have down years, they would still pull over a million in attendance.
Wow.
And the Bucks, you know, they had a few down years and they still did okay.
Yeah.
And of course the Packers had 20 lean years, and you had to wait 20, 30 years to get season tickets.
Right. And you were lucky because you got to go sit in there in the warmth after they redid Lambeau Field.
You know, it's so funny, in the new press box, I always knew one of our sports guys would sit to my right, but I'd never know who would sit on my left. Many times it was a former player.
Uh-huh.
And when you're in there, you can't cheer or yell. You're supposed to be very professional.
Right.
Of course, these ex-players, they don't care. They're ex-players. Well, one day, Don Majkowski sits next to me.
Oh, cool.
Who is the quarterback Brett Favre replaced.
Uh-huh.
And he's got his yellow legal pad. I remember the Packers were playing Tampa Bay that day, and that's back when they had that great defense.
Uh-huh.
Warren Sapp and all those people.
Uh-huh.
He was watching the defense, and every time the Tampa Bay defense would make a great play, Don would say, "Did you see that? Did you see that?" Then he would diagram the play for me on his legal pad.
Oh, cool.
And the professional in me was going, "Wow, that's really interesting." And it was. And the fan in me kept wanting to say, "Don, can you autograph that and give it to me?"
Well, we had a guy that went to Utah State that played for the Pack named MacArthur Lane.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Running back.
Yeah, he went to Utah State, and my wife worked at Utah State in the president's office as secretarial help, and MacArthur Lane got to come in one day. And when he played for the Cardinals, I was a big fan. Then he moved over to the Pack, and we got Donnie Anderson instead. Mm-hmm. And that trade, that was a terrible trade. But when she came on, she said, "I got to meet MacArthur Lane." I was going, "You didn't get me an autograph?" I was a big fan of MacArthur Lane, big fan of football altogether, and just awesome. You got to meet some incredible people, and it sounds like you worked for some very nice people over the years.
I did. One quick thing, I'll let you go.
Oh, no
problem.
Right
after one of the big renovations of Lambeau, and it was a playoff game. I think it was against the 49ers, and I'm still learning my way around here. And I'm walking around, just kind of looking for the right door to go in. And you got to remember, it's January and stinking cold.
Oh, yeah.
And I see this just smoking hot woman walking towards me wearing these skin-tight pants and a tight midriff top with her belly button showing. And I'm trying not to stare. And I'm thinking, who the heck is this? Well, then she gets right by me. I said, "Oh, it's Deanna Favre."
That would do it. Yeah, she was a nice looking woman. So.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, and you have an open invitation anytime you want to be on, and I'll keep your name handy. Maybe we can do this again.
That sounds good. I appreciate it.
And that's Radio Guy Reflections, a podcast about radio and the people behind the microphone. In future podcasts, we'll look at what makes a successful and sometimes a train wreck of a radio show.
As we say in the radio business, if you put that on the radio, people will listen to it.
We'll talk with people who started in radio and moved on to success in other fields. Radio Guy Reflections. We'll be back soon with another show about radio and the men and women who produce the radio programs you've loved to listen to. Radio Guy Reflections is a production of Dave's Voice Works.